Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Chapter 2 of Physics, a brilliant textbook by Eugene Hetch, published in 1994. Chapter 2, Kinematics, Speed and Velocity. Every atom in every solid object, including the human body, is jiggling wildly. The Earth is spinning and revolving around a star, which is itself whirling along with the galaxy. The entire universe is expanding. Everything is in motion. When anything happens, when an event occurs, there is a change, and the change on a fundamental level is predicted by motion. The idea of motion is so basic that it has occupied the thought for millennia. We still struggle with the subtleties of space and time. Physics quantifies, it associates numbers with concepts in a way that renders them measurable. In particular, the branch of physics that describes motion, that defines the needed ideas and develops their interrelationships with no concern for what is causing the motion, is known as kinematics. This chapter develops the concepts of speed, displacement, velocity, and relative velocity. Once these ideas are in place, we go on to study the changes in velocity acceleration, Chapter 3. Thus armed with kinematics, the vocabulary of motion, we begin to understand dynamics, what drives the motion, what drives the universe. Getting speed. The faster a thing moves, the farther it goes in an interval of time. We have a meter sticks to determine distance and clocks to determine time. We only need to relate these two fundamental ideas to quantify speed, to measure how fast. Among the oldest existing thoughts on the subject are those of Aristotle, and he, like his fellow Greeks of the era, specified speed as the distance travelled for a given amount of time. That's the way it was treated for well over 1,000 years. Travelled with a speed of so many miles in so many hours. Not per hour, but in so many hours. Okay, so it's interesting that the Greeks couldn't actually divide it, the two. Let's see. 2.1, average speed. Today, we define average speed as the distance travelled divided by the time it took to do the travelling, or average speed equals distance travelled over time elapsed. Dividing by time in specific units, seconds or minutes or hours, yields a distance covered per unit time. Oh, here we go. So the Greeks never performed that division, apparently because they could not bring themselves philosophically to divide unlike quantities of space and time. The division creates a new concept, a single quantity with a single numerical value with its own unit. The above definition can be expressed symbolically as V average L on T. Thank goodness they've used L, okay. Where V average is the speed. L is the length of past travel, and I've got a footnote. We do not use S for the speed because it has often been associated with the displacement in space. Now, the symbol V derives from the word velocity. Okay, well, I would also agree. I think S is a really bad thing to use. I'd put D with a subscript, or an R if it's a radial distance. The time it took to travel it. The units of speed always are those of length over time, kilometres per hour, metres per seconds, and so on. The automobile travelling a total along the road distance of 30 kilometres in 0.2 hours has got an average speed of 15 kilometres per hour. Evidently, it would have stopped a few times on the way and sped up to still cover the 30 kilometres in the same 2 hours. That's why we call the concept of average speed. A wooden horse on a carousel can swing around the pedestal through 40 metres in 20 seconds. And though it would be forever coming back to the same spot, it still travels with an average speed of 40 metres divided by 20 seconds, or 2.0 metres per second. Speed is independent of the direction of motion, and like all such quantities that have nothing to do with spatial orientation, such as temperature, time, mass, density, charge, and volume, it is only a scale or size. It's not associated with direction. Accordingly, it's called a scalar quantity, a scale quantity. I don't know. Glad. Table 2.1 with typical speeds shows some typical speeds, and table 2.2 compares them. Oh, well, okay. Typical speeds. On average, speed in one set of units can be expressed in any other sets of unit. The speed of light is roughly 3 by 10 to the 8 meters per second. And that's what the speed is. Now, it's interesting looking down here, the Earth, Sun travel around the galaxy at 210,000 meters per second. So that's roughly a thousandth the speed of light. For a 10,000th the speed of light is the Earth around the Sun. And nearly a third of a millionth the speed of light is the Moon around the Earth. And it sort of goes down. The speed of sound is a million times, a bit under a million times the speed, a bit over a million times the speed of light. And a swimming sperm travels at 0.00045 meters per second. So it travels at 0.45 millimeters per second. That's a bit high. Oh yeah, that's the entire thing is sperm. It's a bit hard to work that out. I don't know if that number's correct. Size of quantity in different chambers, for example, 15 kilometers per hour into meters per second, convert kilometers into meters by, this is good, multiplying 1,000 meters divided by 1 kilometers. So you multiply by 1. I like this. This is good, which equals 1 exactly. So 15 kilometers divided by 1 hour times 1,000 meters on 1 kilometer gives you 5,000 meters on 1 hour. So to convert to meters, 15 kilometers to meters, you multiply it by 1,000, but that's actually multiplying it by 1,000 meters divided by kilometers, and you actually cancel. So you actually cancel the, I'll just read that one again. 15 km, forget the 1 hour, 15 km times 1,000 meters divided by 1 km, the 1 km cancels with the km, and so 15 kilometers is 5,000 meters. To convert the expression of meters per second, multiply whatever it takes to transform hours into seconds. So you then I have per hour, I put an hour, so it's 1 hour over 360,000 seconds. Because they're units, it's you're allowed to do that. So 1 hour over 3,600 seconds is actually one. You have to do it. This is a far more rigorous way of converting units. Converting from one system units to another is practical and essentially, well, not us in the United States. Okay, there are problems in the US with the conversion, so they have to be much more careful in the United States with miles and stuff. Okay, moving ahead, at 2.2 constant speed, all of us have travelled in automobiles and have some intuitive sense of what constant or uniform speed is. Just keep a speedometer locked, say at 55 kilometres an hour, and you have it. Scholars of the Middle Ages produced the first workable definition. Uniform speed corresponds to traversal of equal distances in equal intervals of time at any fixed duration, however small. Okay, so that's saying it's actually quite good. However small, was very careful to stress the word any in his definition. Who was that again? Well, Galileo, 300 years later, was very careful to express the word any in his definition. If the interval is large, a body is moving alternately faster and slower, it still can have the same average speed over which the interval of time is seen to be moving with constant speed. So you can have an average speed and constant speed. V constant is the constant speed with which some object moves. Then that is clearly also the average speed, and equation 2.1 becomes V constant over LT. The path length travelled in a given time at fixed speed is L equals V constant times time. When the average speed is constant, or we know the average speed, the distance traversed during any time can be determined. Figure 2.3 is a distance time graph of a bumblebee flying at constant speed at 10 meters per second, starting at t equals 0, L equals 0, the B traverses 10 meters during each second of a straight line. The slope of the line is the ratio of the rise of the run, the vertical distance between any two points on the line divided by the horizontal separation. For the points shown in the figure, the rise is 30 meters minus 10 meters equals 20 meters, and the run is 3 seconds minus 1 second, which is 2 seconds. The slope is 20 meters divided by 2 seconds, is 10 meters per second. The slope of the straight line numerically equals the value of the constant speed. A faster object produces a greater slope. Another important plot is the speed-time graph, which in case of constant speed is simple. At each of the first, second, third, fourth, second, so on, the speed is 10 meters per second. Hence, the curve is horizontal and straight. The rectangular area contained under the line within, say, the first 3 seconds of flight equals the height, that is the speed, multiplied by the length, which is 3 seconds, leads 30 meters, the distance. The bee has travelled 30 meters in those 3 seconds. The area under a speed-time curve bound by any two moments in time equals the distance travelled during that interval. This statement may not seem like much of a revelation in this instance, but it applies to all speed-time graphs. In fact, it was in order to determine such ideas that integral calculus was devised. Actually, quite good there. 2.3, delta notation, the change in a quantity. Imagine now that you decide to measure the average speed of your new Ferrari. As you pass some arbitrary initial point on the road, you watch the initial time of 12.04 seconds. Just at that moment, the odometer shows the initial distance of some other kilometres. A far-off tree marks the final point of the course. As the car passes, the odometer reads the final distance. The Greek capital letter delta has been replaced before the symbol for some quantity. That means the change in that quantity. Thus, delta E means red del L. Delta L. Okay, eel. I don't know why they say that. The change in distance or the length is delta L equals LF minus LI. They're using subscripts, which... Look, physicists have used subscripts. I don't understand why people don't use subscripts at school. Similarly, delta T is the change in time or the duration elapsed. Delta T is TF minus TI. So V average equals delta L over delta T. So you've got this, the instantaneous, the V constant, but V average is LF minus LI over TF minus TI. In the case where delta L equals 10 kilometres and delta T equals 10 minutes, or a sixth of an hour, V average equals 60 kilometres per hour. This form of the equation is useful when the data is presented in terms of initial and final values, as opposed to overall length of time. Had you used a stopwatch and a settable odometer or trip meter, you could have started to run at T naught and L naught, and hence you've got delta T equals L, delta L equals LF equals L equals 10 kilometres. 2.4, instantaneous speed. Scholars of the mid-1300s dealt successfully with the ideal form of speed, but when they tried to take the next logical step to define speed at any moment, they failed. They lacked the mathematical imagery of motion that Newton would create centuries later, the calculus of change. While the car on an aeroplane, if you ask how fast am I going now, you would get the instantaneous speed, the speed at the very moment. Today, that's usually read as a speedometer. Still, what we are really talking about. A bumblebee flying in figures 2.3 or 2.5 has a constant speed and does not matter when you yell now. Its speed at that moment, at any moment, would be 10 meters per second. More realistically, 2.7 depicts a non-linear distance time spot. The bee leaps into the air at t equals 0, lands on a flower after flying 2 metres, rests and takes off again. It flies past your nose at 5 seconds, the lights on a branch at 7 seconds. Its average speed of the journey, part of the journey, is the slope of the line at the beginning and the end of the portion. How do we specify speed at an instance? Now, like the one when the bee flew past the point P on the trip to your nose. To that end, to evaluate V average using the time interval L, a small test course that extends along the flight path from a little before to a little after the P. Because it takes a time delta T for the B to traverse delta L, the average speed is again delta L on delta T. Our scheme will become increasingly better as the delta L straddling is delta the P is narrowed. That narrowing will occur if we reduce the time interval of the measurement. And so they do that. The average speed over a tiny distance is equal to this 5 meters per second. Its average speed measured during a small but finite now was opposed to an instantaneous now. It's not necessarily the speed exactly at P, but very close to it. By further shrinking delta T and delta L, we can get as close as we like to the speed now. There is a geometrical way to envision the instantaneous speed that the B at P. As delta T is made ever smaller, delta L also shrinks, and delta L over delta T, the average speed, approaches the slope at the distance of the time curve P. Slope at any curve at any point is the slope of the tangent to the curve of the point. The slope precisely at P is the instantaneous speed at P, just as the slope anywhere along the curve on figure 2.3 is the constant instantaneous speed at 10 meters per second. Okay, and they've calculated the speed there. The central notion here is delta L will become infinitesimally small and delta T will become infinitesimally small, and yet their ratio, delta T, will approach a finite value. A tiny number divided by another tiny number will not itself be tiny. Its limiting value approaches delta L over delta T as delta T approaches zero. That is, as delta T gets infinitesimally small, is the instantaneous speed. Mathematically, it's written as V instantaneous equals the limit as delta T goes to zero of delta L on delta T. So that's absolutely correct. It actually discusses what Newton's are doing. The instantaneous speed is the limiting value of the average speed delta L on delta T determined at the interval over which the averaging takes pass approaches zero. Henceforth, we talk about speed as a concept that is we have in mind. Notice that delta L on delta T is determined as T approaches rather than reaches zero. It would make no sense to ask for an average speed over a zero time interval. Nothing moves a real distance in no time. The definition of average speed falls apart when delta T equals zero. This subtlety was a point of confusion for centuries. It was to solve the very problem of instantaneous speed that Newton devised calculus. Indeed, equation 2.4, which is the V equals the limit of delta T goes to zero, determines the definition of derivative, written as V equals dL dt. So that's a small d there. Speed is a derivative and L with respect to t. No worry, we will not be using calculus for us. It will suffice to think of V as V average, taken over a very tiny interval. Delta t is centered on now, and delta t is small enough for V to be constant within it. Okay, so they've avoided calculus, but I think students have learnt calculus. Morris Klein from 1953, Mathematics and Western Society. This is a small box aside. Neither man, the two founders of calculus, succeeded in doing more with the limit concept proper than confusing himself, his contemporaries, and even his successors. At one point in his Principalia, Newton does state the correct version of the notion of instantaneous rate of change, but apparently he did not recognize this fact. For later writings, he gave a poor explanation of his logic procedure. And this is true. I gave this podcast about reading the Latin. If you read the Latin, read through it, you go, you can actually see all this. Newton didn't produce the finished Newton. It was just a real work in progress. Velocity. To describe the motion of an object completely, we must specify both the rate of travel, that is, the speed and direction. The single concept that once embraces both speed and direction is called velocity. Although we have managed thus far with this just the notion of speed, more complex circumstances will require the consider direction as well. A situation which Several motions occur simultaneously in different directions can be analysed using velocities. For example, a boy running east at 5 metres per second throws a ball north at 10 metres per second with respect to him. In what direction, at what speed, relative to the ground, does the ball travel? We now develop the mathematics needed to treat such directional quantities, velocity, acceleration, momentum, and so on, the mathematics of vectors. Okay, not quite here, not my favourite. Some good point here, the displacement vector, so displacement. The purpose, suppose we put a little turtle on a piece of paper at some point P and leave it on for a while. On our return, the turtle is discovered at a new spot, PF. Nothing is known about the route it took, but we know the turtle has been displaced. Displacement is designated as a straight line shift between its position P naught and PF. Say P initial, but it's my specifying both length and direction. In figure 2.10, the meandering reptile ends up 10 centimetres northeast of where it started. Any concept such as this can be stated completely only if we provide the magnitude and size and direction as the vector quantity. It is standard in textbooks to designate vector quantities by ball oscillators, reminding us that we are dealing with something other than a scalar of a scale. To be precise, the displacement of an object from a starting point P naught is the vector extending from that point to a position of the object finally. Displacement is often considerable interest, as in the case of displacement of a football from a person who threw it. It's a common practice to represent displacement vector as S, the symbol that comes from the idea of space between two points. Mm-hmm. So this is where I don't know, it's just doing my head in. So that's the way I would do it. It's often done incorrectly at school. In figure 2.10, the vector S is represented pictorially by an arrow 10 centimetres long pointing northeast. And if the 10 centimetres is inconveniently long to draw, simply scale it down to 10 anythings and just label it 10 centimetres. The length of an arrow representing the vector corresponds to what length called a magnitude, the positive numerical value of a vector, and is symbolically symbolised by italics and light typeface letter. Thus, the magnitude of the direction of spacement vector is S, which is the scalar simplified to a single number. In this case, equals 10 centimetres. So, yeah. Imagine now the turtle takes off in a new trip across the page, this time travelling at a straight line east for 3 centimetres, thereby undergoing its first displacement, S1, arriving at point A. After an idle moment, it turns 90 degrees left, going from A straight north to 4 centimetres to point PF, thereby undergoing displacement. The resultant displacement with respect to B naught is the vector S, which is independent of the actual path taken to get to PF. Its magnitude can be computed from a right-angle triangle of the famous Pythagoras theorem. Fortunately, the turtle walked two sides of a 3-4-5 right angle triangle, so the hypotenuse is neatly 5 centimetres long. There's a considerable difference between distance and displacement. For instance, imagine yourself throwing a football to someone who's running in zigzags. He started at your side and is now far down the field, dodging the opposition. You certainly might worry about the total distance travelled by the runner. Surely he is considering it. But you are more concerned at the moment-by-moment displacement of the potential receiver with a straight-line arrow from you to him. Beautiful way that's put. Yeah, I just really think it's problematic using S and D and L. Some vector, 2.6, some vector algebra. We have not completely defined what a vector is until we establish some rules for its behaviour. One such needed operation is vector addition. We do not have a complete idea of what numbers or scalars are until we know how to manipulate them, and the same is true for vectors. Referring to figure 2.11, we can envision somehow adding intermediate distance S1 plus S2 to arrive at the total displacement S. It's evident that we cannot simply add the usual algebraic manner. The total path length is travelled as S plus S2, which is the scalar version, is 7 centimetres, while the magnitude of the total displacement is 5 centimetres. Obviously, S does not equal S plus S2. The illustration itself provides a general rule of adding vectors known as the tip-to-tail method. Two vectors are added together by arranging them such that the tail of the second trip is on the first. Okay, with displacement you can do it, but with the forces you have to go from a body diagram to a vector diagram. The sum of the two is called resultant vector. And so now the Australian stuff is we always draw resultant vectors with double line to get it unconfused. Extends to the tail of the first to the tip of the second. In the process of adding two vectors, the sum will not change if either one or both is moved around, provided it's kept parallel to the original direction. So this is translation of vectors. Notice now this is where you've got the body diagram, vector diagram, you can actually displace things. Notice that the turtle had walked north first and then east, and inverting the order of displacement, it would have arrived at the P final, which means that S equals S1 plus S2 or S2 plus S1. With just an ordinary scalars, the order of addition is irrelevant, and you can put either tip or tail when adding two vectors. Figure 2.2 makes the same point, this time with vectors in the form of oblique triangle, which suggests another technique for graphically adding the two vectors. Beginning tip-to-tail scheme, realizing the order of addition is irrelevant, we can construct the resultant vector in two ways, taken together in the form of parallelogram. In other words, draw the two vectors we wish to add, S1 and S2, emerging from the common origin. Using these adjacent lines, we construct a parallelogram. The diagonal emerging from the origin is then resultant 2. I think this might be sheer madness if they're doing it. Once we have the rule for adding two vectors, we can add more vectors. Vectors are either parallel or anti-parallel, that is, oppositely directed, are added tip to tail in the usual way. The result is simple. In the case of two parallel vectors, S1 and S2, the magnitude of the resultant S equals the sum of the magnitudes of the scalar distances. Suppose now that we add vectors S and an identical vector S, the resultant S plus S lies in the same direction as either constituent S is twice as long as before. It would seem reasonable from usual procedures of algebra to write the resultant, so you can put coefficients in front of vectors. This defines multiplication of a vector by a scalar. Accordingly, if S is a displacement of 10 centimetres each and 6S is a displacement of 60 centimetres each, so this is just talking about scalars, doing coefficients. If two vectors are anti-parallel, the magnitudes of the resultant equals the difference of the individual magnitudes, that is, if you're going backwards. Vectors oppositely directed subtract algebraically. Displacement of 10 meters east followed by a displacement of 10 meters west yields a total displacement of 0. If you interpret the symbol minus s as a vector equal in magnitude but anti-parallel, then we get that answer. Accordingly, vector subtraction can be defined as follows. Any vector B can be subtracted from vector A by reversing the direction in the form of minus B, then adding them together in the usual tip to tail. So you have to divert sign a minus vector. Multiplying a vector by a negative scalar multiplies the vector's magnitude in the usual way, but reverses its direction. If S is a displacement of 10 centimeters east, at 6 and minus 6S is a displacement of 60 centimeters west, note that the magnitude is always positive. Each of these operations, vector addition, subtraction, multiplication, and by a scalar, has a direct application in the description of a physical universe. So these are just the basic vector facts that you have to do about how you add them and increase them in size, and you often forget to teach this basic stuff at school. 2.7 average velocity, the speed of a scalar that tells us how fast without dealing with in what direction. But the more often than not, direction is the essential aspect of motion. There is a difference between the command march at 2 kilometres an hour, march at 2 kilometres an hour south towards the cliff. The accumulating effect concept of this chapter is the instantaneous velocity, and to understand it, we have to examine what happens on the average velocity vector t delta t goes to zero. As we shall see, the instantaneous velocity vector, whose direction at any moment is the direction of motion and the magnitude is the speed. Back to our bumblebee, which at time t now flies from point zero to p0 to pf in an arc as shown there, we see from the equation 2.1 the bee's average speed v average dl to t, and with the expansion of the guard, we define the average velocity to be a vector formed by the ratio of displacement measured by the starting point of the motion and the time elapsed. V average equals s on t. Since t is a positive scalar, multiplying s by l on t has no effect on the direction. V average is parallel to s. The average velocity is necessarily ideal on the way to considering instantaneous velocity. Although by itself the average is of limited usefulness, a race car roaring around a track will have a zero displacement and a zero average velocity whenever it returns to the starting point, no matter how fast it's going. Before the idea of instantaneous speed was introduced, we studied the average speed in terms of intervals, delta L and delta T. The same thinking applies to average velocity, where we now focus on a portion of the flight on the left delta big L. And the bee in figure 2.8 flies a segment of the path PI to PF in the time delta S. The vector S measured from P0 changes as it tracks the bumblebee at an instant by instant, as delta S equals the final displacement with respect to P0. The symbolic form of the final displacement with respect to the symbolic form is delta I plus delta S equals delta F. Therefore, delta S equals delta F. Sorry, delta S equals SF minus SI, which is reminiscent of the length one. Note that delta S is also a displacement, and therefore the B is the respective starting point. Using the definition starter, we can now express the average velocity over a curve route. V average equals SF minus SI, which are vectors, divided by TF minus TI. Notice that the point PI and PF are coincidence. Delta S equals zero, V average equals zero. I'm going to stop here and move on from 2.8. And farther. Pages and pages to go through. It's well worth it, guys. Let's do velocity. I'm just clicking through here. This is a huge amount of space to get through. So that's page 37. We've got another 10 pages on velocity. So I'll take a break here, and typically that will be the first half of chapter 2. Thanks for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.